Our sermon text this week is Galatians chapter 4, verses 1 through 7. And Paul is continuing here to try to confront the mindset of the Galatians, which essentially said you get in to salvation by Christ, but you stay in by your works. And again, their version of that error, there are many of them out there, was by saying you stay in by obeying the old covenant. Paul has been showing them that they misunderstood the point of the old covenant if they thought that was a way to stay in salvation won by Christ. And he has said things like, if we stay in by our works, or by the law, he'll say, then Christ died for nothing. If he didn't do it all, and there was part that we do, then he gave his whole self, his entire life, for nothing. If all we needed to do was work a little harder, why did God waste his son's life? If all we needed was help, some assistance, a little bit of a power boost, what's the point of crucifying the Son of God, of his becoming man in the first place? No, he did this because our only hope was a substitute to do this for us. And so he continues to show that when you think along these lines of having to do enough to continue to receive the Father's favor, you're actually placing yourself in a form of slavery. He said that earlier in chapter 1, and he's going to unpack that a little bit more now as he compares living as a slave versus living as an adopted heir of all that Christ has done. So hear now the word of the Lord, Galatians chapter 4, verse 1. I mean that the heir, as long as he is a child, is no different from a slave, though he is the owner of everything. But he is under guardians and managers until the date set by his father. In the same way, we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of this world. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So, you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. The word of the Lord. So kids, all eyes here up on the screen, and all ears listening to what I have to say here, because God, even though we're separated right now, God still wants you kids to know how much he loves you. And he wants you also to know how you can show your love to him. So, I don't know if you were able to understand what the Bible verses were saying today, but they ask a question, and I'll ask this question to you. Would you rather get $1 billion when someone dies and they give that to you? It's called an inheritance. I don't know if you know that word. But when people die, they often give all the things they own to other people. Usually it's their family members. So let's say you had a really rich uncle. And he died, and he gave $1 billion to you. Would you rather receive that, or would you rather live as somebody's slave who gets no money at all? Which one do you want? This is going to be a hard choice, right? No, it's not going to be hard. Who would ever turn down $1 billion to go be a slave, right? No one who's thinking right would ever do that. But you know what? We actually do kind of make a choice that's just that bad. In fact, it's a worse choice than that. And that's what the Bible verses we read today were talking about. Because sometimes we are tempted to think, and the devil wants you to think this way, that God won't love you unless you do enough good things. And what our Bible verses said today was that's like living like a slave. Because if you trust in Jesus, Jesus was good for you. And he was punished for the sins you do, so you won't have to be punished by God and sent away. And because he did that, he earned a place for you in heaven forever. And what's better, forever in heaven or $1 billion? Even though $1 billion would be nice, forever in heaven's way better. And Jesus kind of gave that to you like that rich uncle would give that money. You didn't earn it. Jesus did. You didn't earn that money. Your uncle did. But he gave it to you, and now that's your property. And you have to be perfect to go to heaven. Jesus was perfect for you. And so that means God's always going to love you as much as he loves Jesus. That's your inheritance from what Jesus did. So don't let yourself think that God might turn you away or not let you into heaven because of wrong things you've done. Because that's like living like a slave who doesn't get an inheritance. Remember instead that Jesus earned it all for you. And so you can tell God, God, thank you. I love you. And you can ask God to help you do things he loves to thank him for what Jesus did. Because he gave you that inheritance that's even better than $1 billion. All right. Thank you, kids, for listening. So as I said, this get in by grace or get in by Christ and then stay in by works mentality is continuing to be undone by Paul here. He's been focusing on the misunderstood covenants that they were mixing up, and he's been focusing on the fact they misunderstood the whole point of the law, which can mean all the things we talked about last week, and the point of that old covenant or that law was not to show you a way to get in and stay in, but instead to point out your sin. As you watch Israel fail to be able to stay in God's kingdom by their works, it's supposed to show us that means we have no chance of our works keeping us in the kingdom of God. Instead, let's trust in that Messiah who gives us an inheritance that will last forever. And so Paul's going to really focus here this week as on something he's been mentioning, but he's going to zoom in now on this idea of how important it is that we understand our role as heirs of what Christ has done. And so, why is it important to remember that we are heirs? Our first point will focus on this. If we don't, we're enslaved. If we don't approach God with the mindset of an heir, we're enslaved. Second, we get that inheritance by Christ being our substitute. We need a substitute, not just help. We need a substitute, not merely help. And then we're going to see, finally, what we actually inherit through our adoption. What we inherit through our adoption. So let's take a look again at what Paul says in verses 1 and 2. I mean that the heir, as long as he is a child, is no different from a slave, though he is the owner of everything. But he is under guardians and managers until the date set by his father. In the same way, we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. So again, the Galatians were freely giving up the freedom that Christ had won for them. Paul will focus more on that later in this epistle. But no one forced them to do this. They were choosing to make themselves slaves again. Very much similar to what Israel was willing to do in the desert. As that is a picture of our Christian life being freed from slavery like they were in Egypt on our way to the promised land. When they ran into difficulties, what did they want to do? Let's go back and be slaves again. So of all things, we can eat those delicious Egyptian onions and not have to eat the manna God gives us from heaven every day. And that, I hope you realize, as I say to you often, one of the dumbest decisions I've ever seen in Scripture. But please don't let it be missed that we do similar things when we think that our lives win God's favor for us or stave off his wrath from us. And what Paul says is here is you are acting as someone who's already received the inheritance, but you're actually giving it up to go live like a child again. And one of the things I was going to do for the kids' sermon was to ask the kids, would they like to be grown-ups right now? Because, kids, what can those grown-ups do? They can go to bed whenever they want. Know what grown-ups are allowed to eat? Whatever they want, because no one tells them they can't have any more. And you know what? No one ever tells a grown-up what they have to wear. Grown-ups can choose whatever they want. And even though sometimes grown-ups talk like they wish they were kids again, I wonder if they would actually want to go back to not getting to make all those decisions for themselves. And what Paul is saying here is, you have been given this kind of freedom, won for you by Christ, and you're giving it up to go not have the inheritance that has been won for you. And no one is specifically saying, you know, I think I'd like to be enslaved. I think I would really love to not have the security that Christ's life has won for me. I'd rather go back to a fearful state where it all depends on me. I think there's a more secure way to live. No one's saying that. But because it makes more sense to us to live that way, we do it without even knowing. And find ourselves wrapped around this axle we put ourselves on of not getting to enjoy the freedom Christ has won for us by doing the hard work of earning that inheritance, earning God's favor for us, and then giving it to us for free. And so how does an inheritance come to the heirs that receive it? We mentioned last week, heirs don't earn an inheritance. By default, someone else does. But even back in the day of the first century here, even before that, inheritance was secured by an agreement, by a promise. And one of the synonyms you would have in Greek for this was through a testament. We use the phrase that way now. Last will and testament is what you how you pass on your belongings, the things you've earned, to those who are your heirs. And so for us, it's God. It's God's covenant promises. Again, first in the garden to Adam and Eve, who didn't deserve it, reiterated again to Abraham, who also didn't deserve it, also reiterated to David, I should say, and then prophesied in what will be the new covenant, and then all that ratified by Christ's life and death, and then delivered to God's people on the day of Pentecost when the Spirit came and brought the Spirit of the risen Christ into the lives of his people. That's God's covenant promises, his testament to us, all based on his earnings and his promise keeping, not based on what we do. So what Paul says is that when we, meaning the people of God, kind of envision as Israel, okay, remember, they show us our story. When they were under the old covenant, they were like what? Children waiting to inherit. Because that law kept reminding them, you fail, you fail. And Paul said, children, they're promised everything, but they can't enjoy the freedom yet because they're under guardians. We mentioned the law as that tutor that would follow the kid around and remind them, you failed. And the law's not lying. We never live a life, a single day, I should say, loving God with heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loving neighbors the way that we should. So God's beautiful standard is always going to be reminding us. Whether we see it in the life of Israel, pointing to us, or in the law that we mentioned last week is on our hearts, or the laws we see in the Word of God reminding Christians how they should be living, it's always going to remind us we fall short. If we think that God's favor depends on us not falling short, then we are absolutely enslaved. We can't enjoy any of the freedom Christ has won for us. When the law points us to Christ, though, as it was designed to do, we can find true biblical sorrow for that sin, leading us right to the foot of the cross where we see Christ taking that punishment we deserve for that sin that was just pointed out to us. And then we can be full of gratitude, knowing I'm not going to face that. I'm free from the curse of the law. I'm free from my death sentence. Christ took it for me. That's part of my inheritance that I can enjoy right now, even though so much more is coming when we finally see him face to face. So the law was designed to beat worldly wisdom out of our heads. Why would I say worldly wisdom? Well, that's what Paul said here in verse 3. He said, in the same way also, when we were children, we were enslaved to the elementary principles of this world. That might have been a fairly shocking, earth-shattering maybe, but kind of an eyebrow-raising way for Paul to explain what he's saying here. Because I don't think too many of us would say that the old covenant that a holy God put on his nation of Israel is worldly. But Paul's meaning it, not sinful, but it's the way this world operates. How did you succeed in the old covenant? Do what God says, you get rich. Do not do what God says, you get killed. That's the way this world operates, and it should. But we have to beat that worldly wisdom out of our heads, or let the law do that, I should say, so we are driven to the foolishness of the gospel. And that's what Paul says there to the Corinthians. You guys wanted all kinds of worldly wisdom. You wanted me to come and entertain you with things you're used to, but sorry, I'm going to preach Christ crucified. And I know that your instincts as well as this world's instincts say that's foolish. You should earn your place. And if you don't, you should be fired. But Christ has done what we needed for us. And it takes humility to realize that's how bad my problem is. That's how much help I actually need. But there is no other hope. And so, again, so Paul's not saying you were enslaved to so much sinful ways of thinking or approaching God, but as to what seems the most reasonable to you as far as how you would gain God's favor. And the old covenant was designed according to the principles of this world so that we could see that what seems so incredibly reasonable still wasn't able to fix our problem. And I've mentioned it to you before. I think we often would think that if we were given something similar to Israel's deal, we would never struggle again. Vast, vast riches for me and for generations of my family if we just don't turn away from the Lord. And then, as a threat, severe punishment beyond we could ever imagine, falling upon our own children, should we turn away from Him. I'll never turn away again. I can't wait to get this fat paycheck. This is going to be great. I don't have to wait for years and years and years to a heaven that I can't see. I'll get it all right now. And within one generation of Israel being given those terms, they turned away from the Lord and continued to for hundreds of years. So let that be our lesson. What seems so reasonable and is reasonable for God to make those requests is still not good enough to fix our problem because our problem is so bad. Even something as eminently reasonable as that kind of arrangement can't fix us. We need only His gospel. And we got to realize that while there's going to be forces within us, our entire life this side of heaven that will tell you it's too good to be true, you don't need that, all kinds of terrible suggestions from our old nature, from the devil, from the world around us. No matter what they say, it is truly our only hope. And scholars have said that this idea of elementary principles is often linked to the idea of being pagan. And it's a very pagan way to approach God. You see the caricatures of the ancient pagan religions. Just find the young maiden, throw her in the volcano, and then that God will be appeased. Make the proper sacrifices, and then you'll get the rain on your crops. You're always just doing things to get. And that's really what this way of approaching God is. If His favor depends on me, I got to do what I got to do to get it. But usually, again, as I said last week, that's always moved or motivated by what? I got to care for myself, since I can't trust the future that God has for me. It's got to depend on me. But while it's also linked to being pagan, it's linked to being elementary in the sense that it's an immature way of approaching God. Think of some of the things that you parents out there have to instill in your young children. You actually have to enforce no biting rules. You have to enforce how to use the bathroom. And then once you know how to use that, to still flush. And these very immature kinds of things you have to instill in your kids, or think of the alternatives, what they might turn out to be if these things are not instilled in them. And think of the way we have to go about some of that. It's an analogy I've used with you before. We use broccoli as my favorite one. What do we parents have to do, and I'll admit maybe sometimes sink to get our kids to finish that broccoli? Threats? No dessert? No dessert for a month? 10 times more broccoli if you don't eat it? Or, in our weaker moments, dangling that dessert in front of them. Bribery. 10 times more dessert if you just eat this broccoli. Okay. None of that actually has to do with instilling in them a value for nutrition. It's just, we care about the nutrition. They don't. Let's get that broccoli down their throats. But we would think of ourselves probably as failures as parents if that was still required to get them to eat broccoli when they were in their 20s. Imagine approaching a 20-year-old with a donut. You get this donut if you eat that broccoli. Okay. No, you want them to mature beyond being motivated by the threat or the reward to do it because it's the right thing to do. To eat it, whether they like the taste or not, because they value nutrition. They value what's right. And an old covenant way of approaching God, or a get in by Christ, stay in by works mentality, what the Galatians are doing, is an immature, childish way of approaching the Lord. I want this thing from you, God, so I'll go do what you said. I'm afraid you'll turn away from me, God, so I'll avoid this sinful thing I was contemplating doing. All about me. Pagan and immature. We are no longer these children. We are heirs. We have received the beginning payments of this incredible inheritance. We should live according to that, not according to the elementary principles of this world and a childish, selfish approach to God. So how would people like us, if we're going to be focusing on my role as an heir, how can we even get this inheritance? What do we do to qualify? Well, we didn't qualify. Christ was our substitute who qualified for us. So we've got to remember his role as a substitute. As Paul says here in verse 4, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law so that we might receive adoption as sons. So anyone who's entertaining this idea of my works can get God's favor, in some way, shape, or form has to think that what they needed was not a substitute, but just some help. Because if he didn't do it all, and there's some left for you to do, then he's not a substitute. He just gave you some help, and now you need continued help to complete what's before you. I'm not aware of anyone, even the most ardent atheists, who would claim that they are perfect. So it is not uncommon for people to admit, oh, yeah, no, I could never perfectly live a life that would receive favor from God. But I just need some help. And there's plenty of Christian literature, or ostensibly Christian literature, out there saying that. What you need most is this trick, this prayer of Jabez, this way of just boning up a little bit and realizing the muscle and the potential that you have. And then you will receive from God all that you ask. I mean, that stuff's all over the place. But Paul says, no, what you needed was someone born of woman. Why would he say that? Well, in this beautiful language here, in the beginning of verse 4, he says, here's, you know, verses 1 through 3, here's us struggling, we're acting like kids, we're not enjoying our inheritance, we are not able to appreciate all that God has done for us. But in the fullness of time, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son. And that phrase is linked in Greek to the drama world. And many have suggested that a synonymous phrase, instead of when the fullness of time had come, would be when the stage was set. This has been God's plan all along. And while his people are struggling, and it's been now 400 years since they've heard a word from the Lord, there they are, under Roman captivity, wondering when is the kingdom going to come. All these promises God gave us in Babylon, but we still haven't seen him yet. God had perfectly set his stage to send his son on this mission to redeem those who are under the law. Meaning what? Under the law's curse, you're all going to die and be rejected for your sin. And he's going to take that for you to redeem those under that curse, under that law. And why do I need to be born of woman? Because as our catechism said today, which by the way was not picked for being linked to this sermon, but God providentially so often links our whole order of worship into the text that we cover. What did our confession of faith say today? You got to have someone who is both God and man to substitute for you. And as Adam was our first representative, we needed what? The second Adam. Because we don't just need some help. We need someone to do it all. This is not someone, our problem is not to the point where we need someone's arm helping us get up the stairs. This is the person who has to consign themselves to a wheelchair. We can't walk anymore. We need something else to do it for us. That's why it takes humility to own our need of the gospel, but it is our only hope. So he was born of woman to be that perfect human representative in our place. But he's also, Paul says, born under the law. So again, as he is the second Adam, he's also the perfect Israelite. As we see humanity's story retold through Israel, we finally have one come and obey that old covenant perfectly. But he also always obeyed the Father to be that perfect representative for all humanity, not breaking anything from that broken covenant of works, always loving the Father perfectly. And so whether it was the Israelites or those under the general law of God, Christ obeyed all of it perfectly. Imagine the king who wrote that law, subjecting himself, living in a sin-cursed body, in a sin-cursed world, voluntarily, even though he never committed any sin, so that he could represent you and be your perfect substitute. So an old covenant mentality says, no, what God wants is just more sacrifices. Just a few more of these, and then I'll stave off his wrath and do my part. But as Samuel famously said to Saul, obedience is better than sacrifice. God doesn't want us just trying to appease him. He wants someone to actually come down and love him the way he called us to. I was a fan of the sitcom News Radio in the 90s. And in one episode, the New York City lawmakers passed an ordinance banning all smoking from the workplace. And this one kind of a diva DJ in this news radio station was a heavy smoker and lit up right there at his desk. And the manager came over and said, what you're doing is punishable by a $100 fine. And he took a huge puff, handed him a $100 bill, and kept going. You see how that doesn't work? The point was not getting the $100. The point was no smoking. So just continuing to flaunt the law and try to appease is ridiculous. And we can laugh at someone in a sitcom doing that. But if we think my ongoing attempts to kind of stave off God's wrath for what I do is reasonable, we got to see it to be as foolish as Paul exposes it to be here. So he was born under the law for us, to both take our penalty for us and give God that obedience he's wanted, not the half-hearted stuff we think will earn his favor. And what was the whole point of this mission? Paul says, to redeem those under the law so that we might receive adoption as sons. This was God's goal. And ladies, you're not cut out of this. In that first century culture, only the son could be an heir. And so that's why we're being adopted as sons. And again, his son is our substitute. We are united to him as though we were Christ, Paul said to us last week. If you're a son, then you're an heir. And again, adoption here is so crucial for us because none of us are born into God's family. All of us need a radical act on God's part to take people who are not his children and then make them his children through a legal act and a legal declaration. And that's what the new covenant did, tying up all the promises. I don't want to call them loose ends as though God hadn't done it right, but it was vaguely promised in the garden and then to Abraham, then to David, prophesied in the new covenant, comes to fruition when our older brother, Christ, represents us and allows God to adopt people like us. Why do I say allows God? Couldn't God do what he wants? God can't contradict himself. God does not have the power to just take people who are sinners, who are traitors against him, and just decide to be their father. Something has to be done about their treason. And if God says the treason doesn't matter, he has contradicted himself. He can't do it. He always must be true to his character. So someone else needs to then be punished for that treason. Someone else needs to be a perfect son in our place for him to then give us credit for that and adopt us as his heirs. And so, what do we inherit is our final point through this adoption. I hope it seemed bizarre to you. I pray this way often for us. I hope it seems bizarre that the King of Kings would take former traitors and instead of executing them as they deserve, has not just pardoned them, but made them his own children and then heirs to what? To the kingdom they were once fighting against. Again, we need to let the foolishness of the gospel move us to worship our Father who would do something so crazy from an earthly perspective for people like us who do not deserve it. But nevertheless, we are adopted. We are heirs. And because it depends on Christ, our ongoing response to that, while it matters, does not affect God's view of us, does not affect how sure his promises are. What our response affects is our glorifying of God. And it's reflecting on what we inherit through this adoption that moves us to love him more. So in verse 6, Paul says, "And because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father." It was such a trend. You're probably so tired of me saying this, but I feel like obligated that I have to say it each time. That while it was vogue to say a few years ago that Abba means daddy, like it's a nickname, kind of like a baby saying Papa or something like that, that has been disproven 1,000 times over. But I'm not saying this to create distance between you and God. What I'm trying to show you is that we have something even better than this cutesy little nickname we get to call the King of Kings. We get to call him Father. And that was a protected term only for children. And slaves who may be living in the house, almost feeling like family, were not permitted to use this term because it was so intimate. And most scholars are convinced that what Paul is reflecting here is exactly what Christ did in the Garden of Gethsemane. He cried out, Abba, as he was so distressed and he knew the access he had to the Father. So with this inheritance, what are we getting? We're not just getting stuff. Though any stuff God would give us would be more than we deserve. We're inheriting a relationship. We're inheriting a status that we never could have acquired for ourselves. And I would like for you to think in a moment about whether you want just stuff versus this status with our Father. Because usually when we are approaching God with an old covenant or a works righteousness mentality, we're motivated by temporary circumstances. I want stuff. I want certain things to go my way. Well, think of the prodigal son. Compare the two different experiences he had with his father. He just wanted stuff. Give me my pay cut. And then went and blew it, and you know where he ended up. Think of his experience the second time around when he thought, maybe I can just go back and live with my father with my works as a servant. It's better than what I'm experiencing now. The father ran out to greet him, would not allow a word out of his mouth as far as this whole servant plan he had. And what did the father bestow upon him instead of stuff? He put his robe on him, which meant his name, which was woven into the pattern, was on him. He gave him a status far better than the stuff he had spent. And that status was going to be his. He's basically readopted his own son who had disowned him. So I want to give you a status relationship with me, and we're going to celebrate together that you are now home. And that's what our Father has given us through Christ. We were those disowning him. But he has adopted us back and given us his name, covered us with his righteousness, so we could be adopted and have his name be on us. And so we couldn't call him Father if he had not adopted us. And if you see here, it says the Spirit is calling this out for us. He sent his Spirit into our hearts, and the Spirit's crying, Abba, Father. Now in Romans 8, Paul says we get to cry, Abba, Father. What we're seeing is that both are true. Our ability to communicate to him by calling upon him properly is not what secures our ability to enjoy this status. The Spirit's doing it for us. As Paul says elsewhere, he prays for us also, fixing our prayers, interceding for us with groans too deep for words. But we get to cry this. It's not just something I get to call God. I get to cry out to him, and he knows me as his child. I've used this analogy with you before as well. But parents, you know your kids cry, right? You also know the one that's just a front and the one that's actually, okay, they're really hurt. And when you hear that one, it's hard to put into words the motivation you have to get there and care for them and do whatever they need in that moment of them crying out to you. And when you're in danger, let's picture you perhaps falling off the end of a cliff and you're hanging on for dear life, you would not say, I am my father's son. My dad's called Abba. Now, what would you do? You'd cry out, Abba, Father, help. And you know that he hears you with an intensity far beyond anything we've ever heard our own children. I've read this quote to you before, but Martin Luther says this, when we cry out, Abba, Then the father says, I did not hear anything in the whole world except this single cry, which is such a loud cry in my ears that it fills heaven and earth and drowns out all the cries of everything else. This cry of, O Father, is indeed a very short word, but it includes everything. Not the lips, but the feelings are speaking here, as though one were to say, even though I am surrounded by anxieties and seem to be deserted and banished from thy presence, nevertheless, I am a child of God on account of Christ. I am beloved on account of the beloved. Therefore, this term, Father, when spoken meaningfully in the heart, is an eloquence that even the most eloquent men that have ever been in this world cannot attain. For this is a matter that is expressed not in words, but in cries, which are not articulated in all the words of all the orators, for they are too deep for words. Let's not just gloss over what it means that I get to call God Father. Luther brings such a beautiful picture of what is involved there. And remember, it only comes to us at the cost of the Son giving himself for us. So why would we ever choose slavery over this beautiful picture we have here? Christ has won for us a freedom that is beyond what we can comprehend. And none of us purposefully says, I don't want freedom. We instead do what makes sense to us. We instead listen to what the world says. We listen to the old nature, and we give in to the attacks of the devil and begin to fear that God will turn from us. We begin to fear that our circumstances going wrong around us are a sign of God leaving us. We begin to value temporary things and getting them over the eternal peace that has been won for us by Christ and think selfishly, wanting stuff from God and not loving the status we have as his adopted children, not loving the relationship we have with him as our incredible Father. And so Paul leaves us with this final reminder in verse 7. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. I don't know how you approach God as a slave. I don't know how you check your sonship, your adopted child status at the door, and instead try to maybe guilt God into loving you. Maybe make a case for yourself that you deserve things. But I want to finish with an example from one of the college kids that I used to work at a previous church. His father was a fairly big gun lawyer in Baltimore. But his father had a policy, and that was for his receptionist, if my kids call me, I don't care who I'm meeting with. I want you to put them through. And if they didn't, he told them, you will be fired if you don't give me my kids' calls. And this guy was telling me that he's burned through so many receptionists because none of them actually believed him. And he said he was actually reticent to call his dad sometimes because he was sure it might involve this new receptionist getting fired. Because nobody could believe that the father wanted to give his children that access to him when he's in some kind of high-powered meeting. How did his kids wind up in that set of circumstances? They didn't earn it. They didn't guilt him into it. And they did not demand it. He demanded it for them. He granted that access to them. Why? What had they done? They were his children, and he loved them more than any of his clients. Whatever business he was attending to was not more important than what his kids needed from him. Let that earthly picture point us to an even greater access we have to a greater being than any high-powered lawyer, to a greater being than any of our beloved parents. Our Father has given us access to his throne when we do not deserve it. And when we don't take it up, when we don't live in that kind of freedom, we are choosing slavery over the incredible freedom Christ has won for us. Let's rejoice that we can never lose it, and let's make more of it. Let's take advantage of it, especially in these trying times. Let's go to our Father more than we do and relish the fact that nothing can change the inheritance Christ has won for us. He will always love us as much as he loves Christ. And when you doubt it, picture the Father sighing and rolling his eyes when Christ came into the throne room. I hope it seems foolish, because as ridiculous as that is, so ridiculous is the picture of our Father turning away from us. Whatever status he gave to Christ, he's given to you. Amen.